morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I dedicate today's program to Gary Moon, Cannon Beach Fire Chief Emeritus, who has recently died. Veritable hurricanes of mega wildfires have incinerated forests and human habitat of three Pacific Coast states that Donald Trump hates with special loathing for disregarding his superior comprehension of forest science, among other disputes of his infallibility. The cataclysmic fires in Oregon torched nearly a million acres in just 72 hours. The same hot, dry, and extremely windy patterns have charred more than 600,000 acres simultaneously in Washington. And California is ablaze nearly everywhere, with more than 3 million acres burned so far this season, the vast majority since the middle of August. More than 5 million acres consumed by firestorms, which scientists blame on humanity's reckless addiction to burning of fossil fuels to maintain the modern life of appliances and digital holographic reality. The consequent human disaster is several confirmed deaths and about 100 or more missing in all three states, most or all likely cremated. Hundreds, perhaps thousands of homes lost, most of them in Oregon, where an estimated 40,000 people have been evacuated, and as many as another 500,000 poised to leave. It should also be realized these ferocious fires are not only a human tragedy of death and dislocation. This is literally a zoological holocaust. Animals, reptiles, amphibians, fish, and birds have perished in immolated multitudes, and unknown numbers of surviving wildlife have been perhaps permanently displaced. All of this wilderness carnage makes the 2020 summer fire season the worst ever, with about a third of it yet ahead, succeeding last year's record as the worst ever, to be supervened most likely by next year's calamitous toll in this sudden era of accelerating embroilment of Earth's atmosphere our offending civilization is reluctant to acknowledge, certainly in not time to prevent the Pacific Northwest from devolving into an oceanside desert. Very soon, a long-anticipated earthquake and accompanying tsunami will also be a significant game-changer up here in the far western corner of the lower USA. Whatever happened to Ecotopia? Oregonians have not experienced such a scale of conflagration since the notorious Tillamook Burn fires that almost seared the Coast Mountain Range bald over a period of four massive wildfires, each 6 years apart, beginning in the summer of 1933, each an integration of several fires, and all started by careless logging operations. A famous photograph from the first Tillamook Burn fire shows a monstrous black explosion of smoke hurtling above a mountain peak, which was seen by ships far out on the ocean. This year's California fires have sent plumes of smoke up to 10 miles high, reminiscent of a Hiroshima atomic blast 75 years ago. The hellish firestorms that have scorched Pacific Coast culture these past few weeks, resulting from increased drought, sky-high temperatures, and fierce, hot, Sirocco-style winds blowing across the dry landscape of the American West, all of which are conspicuous symptoms of human-caused global warming, should at least impress the most rigid of climate change skeptics. Donald Trump trashes forest science and claims climate change is a hoax. He blames forest management for the fires that have wiped out forests and communities. When trees fall down after a short period of time, they become very dry, Trump says knowingly, really like a matchstick, and they can explode. Also leaves, Trump insists. When you have leaves on the ground, it's just fuel for the fires. Trump's logic is that forest fires will go away like magic, just like the pandemic plague and climate change, which is a hoax anyway. Joe Biden calls Trump a climate arsonist. Oregon Senator Ron Wyden refutes Trump and says climate change has hit the far western states like a bowling ball. Wyden insists that a reinstituted form of a civilian conservation corps should be put to work reforesting the enormous burn areas of the Pacific Northwest, similar to the years-long receding of the old Tillamook Burn, which would have remained barren wasteland for generations if thousands of Oregon volunteers, which included hordes of schoolchildren, had not painstakingly tramped the blackened mountainsides with bags of tree seed varieties native to Northwest forests. Indeed, without strenuous efforts of reforestation, the danger of degeneration to dry desert land would only intensify climate change. Trump probably has the same low opinion of the men and women who fight forest fires as he has shown toward people in the military, or anyone who does not pursue and attain wealth as though it were life's sole purpose. Of course, he deludes himself and everyone else as he preens as a self-made Croesus. Being a forest fire fighting hotshot is indeed equivalent to the hard-ass, perpetually hardship infantry. And though hotshots are currently regarded as elite combustion extinguishers, they are probably treated like the infantry, as if any possessed intelligence, none would be either hotshot or grunt. Hotshots battle their enemy with handheld weapons, just as their counterpart dog-faced soldiers, axes, brush hooks, Pulaskis, McLeods, and shovels, with which they chop, cleave, and scrape fire breaks through burning wilderness to deny fire its fuel. Wildfire is their enemy, non-human in contrast to soldiers' nemesis. Sinewy, monstrous in scale, incredibly dangerous and threatening, hot as the sun, grasping for fuel and oxygen to grow and remain alive, sucking human lungs dry at the same instant its intense heat evaporates blood and tissue. The casualty rate is comparable. Entire fire crews have been trapped and killed by fires. If it might be any consolation, they probably die instantly, consumed by fire as quickly as if a bomb had fallen on them. Past and recent deaths of forest firefighters underscore the grim reality that suppressing wilderness fires is incredibly dangerous and is rated the most deadly occupation of government service, with the exception of wartime combat. Many years ago, in late summer, a truckload of Forest Service hotshots who had spent nearly a month combating a wickedly dangerous wildfire in mountains above Pasadena, California, drove down the mountain accompanied by a hose crew tanker truck. The hotshot crew sat in the back of a stake-sided truck that might be mistaken for a produce hauler, except for a pair of red lights and siren horn on the top of the cab. The hotshots sat on benches along the sides that enclosed their fire suppression weaponry. They were a weary, ash and dirt-smeared mixture of Anglos, Hispanics, and Navajo. They smelled of smoke, dirt, and sweat. The two trucks turned onto a highway in the valley and approached an elementary school in which children were at recess. Suddenly, the children stopped their play and started to cheer the passing firefighters. Other children from all over the school poured onto the playground and cheered as the two trucks drove past. The men and women on the fire crews who have fought these devastating wildfires in all three states these past weeks deserve no less and much, much more. And that was something I wrote. And now, Dr. Charles Wilder died on this day and date 5 years ago, on Thursday, September 17th, 2015. His friends knew him as Chuck or Charlie, but many were probably unaware of his doctorate in social welfare, which he received from the turbulent Berkeley campus of the University of California. Chuck was a community organizer and the first director of Clatsop County Community Action, which continues 3.5 decades later, as was primarily intended to be, an anti-poverty agency. He was also a professional musician. He played jazz piano in Astoria for a long time in many night spots, either solo or accompanied by musicians and singers, notably his famous longtime duo with the late great drummer Michael Rush. He was a founding member of the North Coast Jazz Quartet. Chuck wrote an article for my now defunct newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle, back in 1987, the March issue, which could very well serve as an autobiographical vignette that aptly reflected his biaxial life. He wrote this mini memoir on Martin Luther King's birthday that year and dedicated it to his three daughters, Adelaide, Cara, and Emily. And I dedicate my reading of on today's program to Chuck and to his wife, Jill, and to his three daughters. My Heroes Have Never Been Cowboys, by Chuck Wilder. And a quote from Chuck: "The war on poverty has become the war on the poor." I grew up with mostly white ethnic steel workers and gangsters in Youngstown, Ohio, where the rivers caught fire and the snow turned gray overnight. The satanic mills are idle now. Good news for the Mahoning and Cuyahoga rivers, but a lingering death for the steel workers. As a kid, I was what they euphemistically called a bad egg. So my family, members of the minority WASP, small business clique, often sent me to my room at night. There I would lie in the dark, fiddling with the dial of my silver tone radio, tracing the contours of the universe like the blind man in the cave. Alan Freed was in Cleveland then, calling himself Moondog. At exactly midnight, this unspeakably funky, erotic baritone sax would launch into his theme, Blues for the Red Boy, by the Todd Rhodes Band. The later it got, the more stations you could pick up: Detroit, Chicago, New York, and from Boston, the legendary Symphony Sid. That's when I started listening to Berg and Art Tatum and Hampton Oz and all those other shadowy, angelic figures who were going to rearrange my life. I was only 13 or 14, but through some genetic fluke, I could hear it right away. I went down to the record store and asked, "Do you have anything by Charlie Parker?" And they brought me this 10-inch LP with his picture on the cover. I took it in my pink little hands and stared at it and thought, "This can't be him. This guy's a nigger." I mean, I really did think nigger, because that's how it was in that grimy little corner of industrial civilization gone berserk. Blacks were okay in their place, far away from our wives and daughters, company boardrooms, labor unions, crime syndicates, etc. They even excelled at certain primitive glandular stuff, like what you heard on some of the Nashville stations back then, or what they had in mind for our wives and daughters. But they weren't supposed to be able to cope very well with the intellectual and moral demands of high civilization, which is why they needed watching rather carefully. they weren't supposed to be able to forge from the crucible of their collective misery our most aesthetically advanced and technically challenging indigenous art form. Something was awry. My parents, neighbors, teachers, etc., were regular Christian folks. They wouldn't lie on purpose. But music has no purpose other than to be heard, and therefore can't lie at all. Anyhow, I wanted to learn it real bad, and the only way to do that was to go where it was being played. So it wasn't long before I was sneaking out of my room down to the local black and tan pubs and roadhouses and after-hours joints. Then on to Cleveland. When I was 15, my dad took me to hear Sonny Stitt at a place called Hi-Hat, and later to Chicago and San Francisco, where history was being made every night at the Beehive and Jimbo's Bop City and other teeming, exotic, subterranean conservatories of that era. At certain times, they'd let me sit in, and that's how I started learning to play. But I learned something else, too. I learned real fast and hard and close up what our lives had done and were doing to a whole beautiful race of men, women, and children. Those buttons the Saul Alinsky organizers used to pass around the ghetto summed it up plenty. Is there life after birth? I got to thinking stuff like, how many Charlie Parkers and Billie Holidays have we effectively maimed, crippled, aborted, destroyed before they even got a chance to fly? And what of all the rest, the ones who couldn't run faster or fly higher than Whitey? Don't forget what they had given me, so I didn't have to wait for Vietnam to experience the kind of radical moral damage, not to be confused with anything so trifling or expungible as guilt, that would push me to the margins of society for the rest of my life. I gave up music for a long time and started reading and listening to Dr. King and getting involved in civil rights activities in the Bay Area. I hung out with beat poets, anarchists, trots, neo-wobblies, Muslims, SDSers, and even some of those real, chilly, straight-looking party guys who would march right into a neighborhood and say, "Are you ready for the citywide rent strike, folks?" I started making the connections between race and poverty, power and privilege, and so on, taking it out into the streets. Heady stuff, and for a while it worked, and partly because it worked, soon enough along came John Kennedy and LBJ with their war on poverty hype, saying, "Hey kid, don't get too weird because we'll send you to graduate school and train you and pay you to fight in a way that'll make your mom and dad and your president proud, and you'll have a real income so you can play music on the weekends." Everybody likes to fit in somewhere, get a little status and legitimacy. I was such a pushover that I'm still doing it 20 years later with Ronnie Reagan at the helm, busting his cruel little britches to rid the land of all of us damaged marginal types. America had found a place for us after all, just like Herbert Marcuse said it would in One Dimensional Man. We would be sequestered in universities and bureaucracies with responsible-sounding names like Human Resource Development Council, Incorporated. We could dissect the beast, contrive piecemeal solutions, and do society's dirty work. They even invented an Alice in Wonderland phrase to describe it, working within the system, just to remind us that there was only one system and who was in control. I wonder how much longer I could do it. It's getting awfully cold out there again, and we're losing so much ground. Mostly, I just want to climb into my bubble and play. Nothing can touch you there, and sometimes you can bring folks a little ways home, back to music as a symbolic form, an evolving of the human spirit, and not just a vortex of sensations. Sometimes I even imagine that if I play my piano good enough, if I squeeze the music out of the deepest chambers of my soul, like the heart pumps blood, maybe it will help bring a few people closer together for a moment or two. That's what it is all about, anyway, what Dr. King really tried to teach us. Which poet said it best? Rex Roth, Auden, Rene Char, we must love one another or die. And at least for that brief, turbulent historical period of the 1960s, lots of us seemed to believe it, to believe that it was possible for each of us to identify with the suffering and thwarted hopes and aspirations of other human beings, wherever they were and whether or not we ever got to know their names or faces. And from that would come solidarity and commitment, sister and brotherhood, vision and steady work, the things Dr. King's birthday will forever stand for and that America has already forgotten. In fact, some people still don't understand why we should have a national holiday for Dr. King. There are too many other deserving candidates, they say, chiefly white males. But I remember in the early 60s when I first started organizing in places like the Mission District and Hunter's Point, where you had families of seven living in two-room high-rise apartments and tenements with rats and roaches, rotten pipes and cracked plaster, enforced dependency, degradation, despair, and two out of three times there would be a picture on a wall, usually one of those cheap, mass-produced red, white, and blue tapestries, a picture of Martin Luther King. And I'm here to tell you, that's it. That's all the hope there was in that home, and millions like it all across America. Today, we focus our national shame myopically on those who have no home at all. We invent a new sociological category, the homeless, a new code word for wholesale, systematically induced, and thoroughly preventable human misery and despair. The Reagan administration dawdles and broods over the onerous prospect of sending a couple of $100 million on the problem. Not really the problem at all, only its most conspicuous casualties. After it has just finished decimating conventional public housing and other critically needed mainstream social programs in this country, after it has annually approved five times as much money for military bands as it has to house the homeless. And we let them get away with it. It's supposed to be horror land, too. And that's another thing Dr. King tried to teach us. But it isn't anymore. I think we should try and take it back. I think we should quit screwing around, get off this networking kick, another code word for some sort of quasi-political masturbation, and get down to some serious, sustained organizing, coalition building, social and political action. If this strikes some of you as rather old-fashioned and utopian, you're right. Old-fashioned because it's the only means, short of violence, by which a powerless people has ever managed to shape history rather than let it grind them into human fodder. Utopian because you've got to have a pretty big, powerful dream just to lever the real thing forward a few inches at a time. And one way or another, you've got to start at home. Look around the North Coast at all these little enclaves and coteries of artists, craftspeople, intellectuals, anti-nuclear groups, women's and human rights activists, hip entrepreneurs and chic professionals, K-Moonies, Times Eagle muckrakers, and so on. But nothing much ever seems to happen. Just more coffee and conversation, more frazzled indignation, more networking. Some groups will take issue, saying, our impact is subtle, diffuse, prefigurative. You just can't measure it that way. Right. I'll be damned if I can get it to register at all, which I hasten to add is not to dismiss either the intrinsic value or latent potential. Without these groups, we wouldn't even have that. Why, for instance, are we content to hand total initiative for community and economic development over to the Chamber of Commerce, the Port Authority, the military, the absentee corporations? Why do we only react at best? Why not get our own dreams and our own act together? If we don't, you can bet your quiche who's going to lose out, and then you may have to go someplace else to get away from the beast and talk about what needs to be done without bothering to do it. Of course, we're not unique. It's the same all over America these days. Why try to keep it secret? We're through trying. We've washed our hands of it. We just want to be left alone with our toys, our career paths, our self-fulfilling little projects and diversions, our omnivorous pursuit of meaningful relationships, and rosy self-images, and that would be just fine. Who am I to knock it, except for two things? First, we have no right to allow other people, very large numbers of people indeed, to suffer as a result of the same institutional arrangements that make it possible for us to carry on this way. Obviously, I am convinced not only that we have no such right, but also a positive obligation to change these arrangements. But I can't prove it to you. Either you understand it or you don't. Second, there is growing, many say conclusive, evidence that the planet itself cannot endure arrangements of this kind much longer. It needs us to come back to each other. Just like the poet said, it needs us now. To these ears, it cries to us almost the way Billie Holiday did when she sang Strange Fruit. Southern trees, bears, strange fruit, blood on the leaves, and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Once upon a time, Martin Luther King was my hero because I thought he stood for the kind of person we should all try to become in order to make a better world. It's no fairy tale any longer, but maybe I was wrong. Maybe he stood for what we must become to keep the one we've got. And that was, my heroes have never been cowboys, by the late Chuck Wilder. This is Michael McCusker. David Kruger has died. He was a Renaissance revivalist, a teacher, and a chemist, backwoods hiker, and passionate KMUN community media advocate. He did indeed go fly a kite and paddled his own kayak. He once compared Astoria to an opera house, to motel construction-prone city officials. Density and height at the hilltop, the riverfront open as a stage so that everybody could enjoy its beauty and drama. Wall Street was bombed a century ago yesterday. No one knows who did it. 33 were killed, 400 injured. And despite the presumed magical disappearance of COVID-19, do not unmask and hug everybody just yet. Remember that self-protection is universal protection also. None of us want a plague on any of our houses. Autumn falls on us Tuesday, 22 Septo 2020. Only you can prevent forest fires. Rake your leaves.